guys are the same old man. Game
Here's Johnny.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
So serious.
I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Welcome to this week's extra film segment for May 25th, 2017. I'm Vince Leo.
And I'm Brendan Cassidy.
And for those not familiar with the extra film segment of the In Session Film Podcast, it's our chance to talk about some of the smaller movies that are out there, whether in theaters in limited selection, or whether it's on VOD or straight to Netflix, or even just coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, or they may even be classics as well. We want to take a look at some of those smaller films and some of those classics. But we have a couple of really good films to talk about today. One is a film that's currently out in limited release by Terrence Davies. It's called A Quiet Passion, and we also will be bringing you a very provocative film, one that got a lot of notoriety for some of the reactions among the audience for those people who saw it in theaters, but it's now currently just been released on VOD, and that is called Raw. And we're going to get into that in just a moment, but first, we want to talk about some of the things that happened just in the last week. A lot of film news that has come out. I know that we have the Cannes Film Festival out there. We got the 40th anniversary celebration of the release of Star Wars into theaters.
Two, and I know that, two celebrations for Star Wars in 1 month. How about that?
I know, that's incredible. And I know that you and JD, since we're on that topic, have some of your retrospective reviews that were compiled on the website. So want to mention that real quick.
Yeah, go back there and check out some of our reviews on the original Star Wars films, which include episodes 1 through 3, the prequel trilogy, where we had some, let's just say, to put it nicely, negative things to say. Yeah. All of that was leading up to the release of The Force Awakens, which was a lot of fun, but we've got even bigger fish to fry when December rolls around for episode 8, The Last Jedi. Looking forward to that as well.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be exciting. And we also had a couple of things that came out this week that are a little bit more somber and a little bit more serious that we want to talk about just briefly. One is Zack Snyder and him being, I guess, taking a leave of absence from the film that he has been working on, Justice League, one of the most anticipated films of the year, especially among comic book fans and those people who have actually enjoyed his work with The Man of Steel and Batman v Superman. I was not a big fan of those, but I definitely was taken aback by that news that he was going to be stepping away because of the tragic loss of his daughter to suicide back in March, and him and stepping in, of course, we have Joss Whedon to try to do a little bit more of the reshoots as well as put all of the existing footage together. So I know that that's a really shocking news, especially from people who are following, obviously, the Justice League film, which is one of the most anticipated films, as I mentioned, this year. Yeah. So do you have any thoughts on that? Because it's really heartbreaking to read about that with Zack Snyder, regardless of whatever you think about his films. You know, I've liked some, I've not liked some, but I really do have a lot of compassion for his situation here.
Yeah, at this point, you know, how you feel about his respective films, I don't think matters at this point. The point is that Zack Snyder himself, he's a member of the film community that we know and love. He's a film fan first, and he's always said that. And no parent should ever have to bury their child, especially under the circumstances that he himself is now going through. And I think what is so, I guess, almost kind of uplifting about this story, as tragic as it is the way Warner Brothers kind of handled it for him, because this tragedy for him happened back in March. And if you really do the math here, while it was also known that this was the reason that he may have to step down from Justice League, which is due out in November, this is something that not just Warner Brothers, but various news outlets also knew about. And the fact that it was refrained from being published until the Snyder family was ready to talk about it, I think that shows a lot of honor in that respective that respective profession. And looking at Warner Brothers, they were willing to push back the release of Justice League to coincide with the tragedy that the Snyder family was going through. And the fact that they were able to, you know, be open with that, I think says a lot that most production companies don't have, you know, the compassion for. And that's really the light at the end of the tunnel with this. It's a devastating loss. You know, I'm with you. I've liked some of Zack Snyder's films. I haven't liked all of them, but that doesn't really matter at this point. I just hope that he is able to spend time with his family, take the time that he needs, and hopefully it leads to a very good healing process in the long run.
I agree with that. I really do reach out to him and his family, and I hope that that they're able to get this very tragic situation to get through that and to be together for that. And the film is in good hands. You got a very, very experienced comic book aficionado and a comic book property director here in Joss Whedon. So yeah. I feel that, the property is in good hands. And like you said, kudos to Warner Brothers for trying to deal with it as best that they can, because this really is kind of one of those cash cow movies for them. This is a tentpole release for them. Yeah. So for them to be willing to push this back or what have you, especially, when it comes to the Twitter sphere and all these other places that can be very vile, to be able to come forward and be supportive of the filmmaker here, I think that is very good for the industry. And and like I said, it is a heartbreaking situation. And as much as I see that he had tried to plow through this, at a certain point, something like that is really hard to deal with. You can't just put it aside for the sake of the film. Sometimes it is something you really have to deal with, and deal with it soon.
I agree.
So, speaking of other tragic news, we also had the passing of Roger Moore, a very beloved figure, a very beloved actor because of his work on, obviously, the James Bond series primarily. Most people know him as James Bond. I grew up with him as James Bond,
right,
being a child of the 70s and into the mid-80s. And, everybody says that your Bond is the one that you grew up with. So I was introduced to James Bond with Roger Moore. So even though Sean Connery, really, to be honest with you, is my Bond, I have a lot of love for Roger Moore as Bond.
Oh, of course.
And as an actor, too. I find him a very genial, very welcoming presence in movies, whether it's in Cannonball Run series, even though those are not really critically acclaimed. I really enjoyed his comic timing in that, and The Sea Wolves and some of these other movies that he's been in. But, what are your thoughts about Roger Moore? Obviously, you've probably seen your share of James Bond films, including ones with Roger Moore, and what he brought to that series and just film in general.
Yeah, you mentioned two words that I want to comment on, and that's comedic timing, because that's something Roger Moore had when compared to the other James Bond, or the actors that portrayed James Bond, more or less. He had a presence and a suave that he brought to James Bond that, whether you liked it or not, you can't deny the impact that Roger Moore had in giving James Bond a sense of staying power into the 1970s and 1980s. It may have been a product of its time, but it was a very appropriate product of its time, because James Bond, as a film property, may not have had the momentum that it had if it wasn't for someone like Roger Moore to carry it through those respective eras. And you look at films like Octopussy and Moonraker, and you can make you can make fun of some of those films for what they are, but they are very cheesy fun. And at the same time, if you look at his entire filmography as James Bond, he has been in some great Bond films, such as For Your Eyes Only and The Spy Who Loved Me, which are my two favorite Bond films that Roger Moore was in.
Absolutely.
So he has been in some great Bond films, and he brought a suave to the character that, in some ways, some of the other Bond actors couldn't really quite match. Not to say that they couldn't bring it, but he brought a uniqueness to the character that I think was unparalleled. So, very sorely missed as well. Died at the age of 89 due to cancer. Very unfortunate. But it seems as though he lived a long and fulfilling life, and there's a lot to be said about that.
Yeah, and absolutely. And everybody who knew him, and you've seen this outpouring of people who knew Roger Moore, and those people who've interviewed Roger Moore, and those people who are like us, film critics who may have known Roger Moore from afar but have had interactions with him or interviews, have all said that he has been a very lovely man in his life, and they are they sorely miss his presence there. He definitely was a much beloved actor, even if, for some reason, some people may, consider Moonraker and some of these other films in the series not as good as other films. But I do want to say, before we get off of that subject, is that as somebody who lived through the mid to late 70s, there was a real, after the Vietnam War was coming to a close and a lot of tragedies throughout the 60s, et cetera, people were just wanting to have escapism, and they wanted laughs, and they wanted fun in the theaters. And that's why Star Wars really took off as a cultural phenomenon there. Disco, of course. People just didn't want to think about something heavy when it came to their films. So I think that the Bond films during that era were more a product of that culture and not necessarily a product of Roger Moore as an actor. Because as you mentioned, he has done a couple of really stellar outings as James Bond. It just happened to be toward the late 70s. People just wanted to have a few laughs for a change during a bleak time in their lives. So much reaching out, of course, to Roger Moore and his family, and he will be sorely missed as well. But
absolutely,
we have a lot to look forward to from this show. We have, obviously, A Quiet Passion, as I mentioned, as well as Raw, two films that are really highly anticipated from a lot of cinephiles out there, and certainly ones that we've had on our radar for some time. So without further ado, let's get into it.
And here we go.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast, Extra Film Segment, and Brendan, I'm sure we'll become fast friends.
Of course we shall. I'm irresistible, as so I've been told.
Will you go with us to church, Miss Buffon?
Of course not. Going to church is like going to Boston. You only enjoy it after you've gotten home.
We are to pray for the repose of our late pastor's soul.
Doesn't that rather depend on where it's gone?
We shall become fast friends.
Of course we shall. I'm irresistible. Everyone says so. When the new pastor does arrive, you must point him out to me.
So that you too may be saved?
No. So that I will know whom to avoid. Don't enjoy your praying too much. It might become habit forming.
All right, so A Quiet Passion is written and directed by Terrence Davies, and it stars Cynthia Nixon, along with Jennifer Ely, Duncan Duff, Keith Carradine, Jodie May, Joanna Bacon, and Catherine Bailey. If you're not familiar with A Quiet Passion, it is the story of American poet Emily Dickinson from her early days as a young schoolgirl to her later years as a reclusive, unrecognized artist. With all of that in mind, Brendan, what did you think about A Quiet Passion?
If you would have told me that A Quiet Passion, the biopic about poet Emily Dickinson, wonderful poet Emily Dickinson, and if you told me that this would be one of the funniest films I would see in 2017, yep. I would have called you crazy. Well, I guess I have to eat those words because A Quiet Passion was one of the most sarcastic experiences I've had as far as watching a film this year, and it really earns that sense of sarcasm and snarkiness to it, especially as it relates to, you know, the hypocrisy of American ideals among this time. And the way that it deals with that alongside these notions of artistic oppression and confinement, it really creates a very well-realized and balanced experience about the life of Emily Dickinson from a young age until her more secluded age when Cynthia Nixon comes in and plays the part after Emma Bell played the more younger portions of Emily Dickinson's life while she was getting pulled out of school and some of those historical aspects of her life. And I think it's that snarkiness that really holds me through the rest of the film. So when it does become a bit more grounded and a bit more, I guess, visceral in the film's final act, that sense of humor, I think, is what allowed you to find a sort of, not just a relatability, but sort of a compassion for Emily Dickinson. Yeah. And the way that she kind of had this almost narcissistic outlook on the world and this sense of sarcasm on the world, and the way that her poems in some ways kind of reflected and mocked the idea of American ideals at this time and the properness of it all. I really respect that Terrence Davies really really goes for that in this film and really utilizes that for the core of this film's emotional heart. And as it does get a bit more serious, he earns where that goes because of how much we find ourselves invested in all of these characters. Yeah. Maybe that shift is a bit abrupt and a bit tonally abrupt at the same time. That's a bit of a minor flaw there, but for a 2-hour film that is meant to just explore the life of Emily Dickinson in this way, it does what a great biopic should, which is something, you know, JD and I have criticized in the past about a lot of biopics these days, is that it focuses on a small portion of this figure's life and utilizes that to understand who this person was, why they chose the form of, I guess, approach that they wanted to go for, in this case being Emily Dickinson and her love of poetry, and what that reflected and why it reflected what it did. I think it's very well realized in that regard, and I was pleasantly surprised by the snarkiness and the humor that it had to offer. I really liked it.
Very good to hear. And I should preface this review by saying that I, even though I have been watching films and reviewing films for, you know, 20 years now, this is actually my first exposure to a Terrence Davies film. So I really didn't have, I have heard of some of his films, The Deep Blue Sea and The House of Mirth and some of these other ones. They just happen to be, for whatever reason, they just happen to be ones that were on my radar, but I never got around to it. And I know that you guys have reviewed Sunset Song, which I know that you had thought quite highly of in that review. And certainly he's well known among cinephile circles. In terms of our wheelhouse, I mean, we all have our blind spots. I know that you guys last week were talking about France and François Ozon. I happen to be much more well versed in the filmography of François Ozon because I'm a huge fan of his. And so I was sorry about missing that particular review. But so when it comes to A Quiet Passion, this is really my first exposure. I say that kind of as a preamble to what I'm about to say, because I know that a lot of people that are listening to this probably have experience. Maybe they're even big fans of Terrence Davies and want to hear what we have to say about that. So this is brand new to me. I will say that it took me a while to get into this movie. I had a hard time with the dialogue is beautifully written, and I will talk about that in terms of it's very witty, it's very pithy. There are funny moments, as you mentioned. The problem that I had, at least in terms of the dialogue, in terms of getting into it, is that there is this very formal way of speaking, which I think that Terrence Davies was intentionally trying to bring in here because of some of the correspondences that he may have read regarding, you know, I think there are three very thick volumes of correspondences between Emily Dickinson and some of her family, some of her friends and cohorts that she had met over the years. Very reclusive woman, but it's really hard to get a gauge as far as the way that when people are actually talking to each other, the rhythm, the way that they come up with these gems of you know, they're very quotable gems. And while I appreciated them, and I could say on paper it probably looked really good, for some reason I had a hard time really getting into it because of the way, like, I never felt that there was a natural way of two people or more speaking to each other in this film. However, the moments in which there is either a montage or a narration or and especially when we get to the second half of this film, there are some really compelling cinematic moments in this movie. And you wouldn't think that there would be, because Emily Dickinson is, as I mentioned, a reclusive woman. She pretty much stayed on her estate. And most of the film really stays on that estate. You see her in her room or quarters or out and about on her, you know, in this estate that is owned by the family. There's not a lot of location changes or anything like that. So in a way, it almost feels, even though this film is not based on a play, it feels like a stage play to a certain extent in certain scenes, depending on. But there is that cinematic approach that Terrence Davies brings in here. And I'm going to name one. I'm almost sure that you would have brought it up even if I had not. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started getting really captivated by what Davies was bringing here, there's a scene in which we go from the younger Emily Dickinson and her family to the older. And the transition between that is unique and beautiful and it's very gorgeous. Telling.
Yeah.
You know, basically they're sitting in front, they're getting their portrait taken. And as we're watching them, when we're zooming in very slowly to their faces, we see either the younger actor that's representing Emily Dickinson or some member of her family, and it transitions, it morphs their face and their bodies into the older representation. So we have a very seamless transition, not only of the passage of time, but also from one actor to another. Now, in the case of Keith Carradine, who's playing both the younger and older version, they are the same, but it is really strikingly done and beautifully done. And you don't have to be told, it's not very ostentatious in terms of, hey, look what I'm doing. But it's beautifully done, and it makes you reflect on that passage of time, which is very much a theme of this movie, the passage of time and the way that people, the families, deal with how families are together, close as a unit when they're very young. And as people get married, people go away, people die, they start coming apart. And for somebody like Emily Dickinson, and this is when I started getting more and more into this film, somebody like Emily Dickinson, whose family, whose home life is really her world, other than the insular world of her thoughts and her poetry, to see that change is, you know, it's almost like the whole world changing for some people, because that is her, the world that she knows, and it impacts her greatly. So from that perspective, what Davies is bringing here, it turned from a movie where I thought, wow, I'm really having a hard time getting into this, this may be a miss for me, to by the end of the film, I was very much riveted and compelled by what was going on. I really am interested in seeing some of that back filmography from Terrence Davies, because I feel that cinematically, he is a really wonderful, talented filmmaker here, as evidenced by this, even though I may have quibbled here and there about the way that the dialogue is presented. So kudos to Terrence Davies.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great symbolism in that moment that you're talking about. From a direction standpoint, the way that it does create this sense of time passing, and you feel that distance of time as it progresses. You could definitely feel that there is a major difference in the film's first 20 minutes compared to where it actually goes. And there's a lot of symbolism there, because you sense how this greatly affects the Emily Dickinson portrayal that we see in this film. And it helps define why she becomes so reclusive throughout the rest of the film. And as she kind of perceives her surroundings and notices that there's a lot of hypocrisy in this world, and there's a lot of fronts that people put on just for the sake of being proper, even though they don't ultimately mean it, that leads to a lot of devastation in her life. And that eventually starts to, you know, be formulated in her own poetry. And the way that the film transitions from that snarkiness to that sense of grounded realism, I actually found pretty profound and interesting. And I think that's also why the dialogue that you're talking about, which you may have had a little bit of problem with, I sympathize with that. I mean, it is, the dialogue in this film at times is almost unnatural in the way that it's performed. And I like that about the film, because it actually helps ground the snarkiness of this film. And I think the satire of this film becomes even stronger because of that, because I think one of Terrence Davies' one of his goals here is to kind of poke fun at that proper lifestyle in a lot of ways. When you look at Emily Dickinson and the relationships that she forms with a few of these people throughout her life, one of them being the woman of Miss Buffum, I believe her name is, played by Catherine Bailey, who I think, aside from Cynthia Nixon, I think Catherine Bailey gives the best performance in this film, who is the epitome of that snarky properness and trying to put up that front. And she's ultimately the realization for the Emily Dickinson character to see that through her own eyes. And having that revelation in front of her, I think, is simultaneously kind of, in some ways, devastating, but still balanced in that satire that I think this film was ultimately going for.
Yeah, and I think that, as you mentioned time and again in your responses, that a lot of people are going to see A Quiet Passion, and maybe they have history with Terrence Davies. Like I said, I didn't have history with Terrence Davies, but from what I've read, a lot of his movies have a little bit more of a melancholy bent. And I'm not saying that that's not evident in this film. There certainly is, because you have the passage of time, you have the passing of people within the course of this film. Certainly, these are really big impacts in Emily Dickinson's life, and you can reflect back on that with a certain degree of sadness. But it is a very funny film. It is a very witty film. It is a very pithy film. And even though I might feel like sometimes it is a little bit too witty, a little bit too pithy in certain ways that they talk to each other, this is, of course, a very subjective observation on my part, which didn't bother you. It did bother me. But I do feel that ultimately this is a film that is very compelling. Now, interestingly enough, this is a biopic, as they call it. But I would be strongly caution for those people who are trying to watch this film as a very accurate representation of Emily Dickinson's life, that Terrence Davies does freely admit that he basically read six biographies on Emily Dickinson and did not choose to go with that in terms of exactly what happened in her life and when and who she had in her life and at what time. He just was really trying to capture the essence of Emily Dickinson as he understood her through the course of reading these biographies and trying to get the gist of that to life. And we've seen that in recent biographies as well, where we're not necessarily getting an accurate representation of, you know, a Wikipedia reading of what they did in their life, but you're getting a much more, I guess, more compelling truth, and much more, you know, it's uncovering something more about the human existence. And certainly the things that Terrence Davies does relate to as somebody who grew up in a very religious background, which Emily Dickinson also did, and it, you know, has questions about that, that religion and what they're trying to provide and make her do. And, you know, she is a nonconformist, as Terrence Davies grew up to be. And some of the interactions with her family and friends and this feeling of being, for a long time, a long period, being unappreciated, not really understood. She wrote about 1,800 poems in her life. Yeah. Only 6 or 7 of those ever saw print during her lifetime. So that must have been very frustrating, because, you know, that may speak to, you know, maybe the view toward women during that time, or some of the dialogue that she may have talked about in her poems may have been seen as a little bit too, I guess, not scandalous, but a little bit edgy for that time period, certainly. Very, you know, obviously when you talk about the great American poets, Emily Dickinson, right there near the top of the list today, a true talent. And we get to hear through voiceover narration some of that really beautiful poetry timed very well by Davies during certain periods of her life to really take advantage of her reflections, not only on her life and her bonds with her family and her friends, but also of her mortality and her spirituality, which I think that's something that Davies is probably himself, somebody who grew up devout Catholic for a certain period of time, struggles with in his own life. So from that perspective, I really do think that this is one artist looking at the through the prism of another artist and really finding a connection and drawing that connection through in a very palpable and very real way.
Yeah, I agree with that. And he's more concerned with the introspective aspects of who Emily Dickinson was versus just trying to narrate her life story in many ways. And I like some of those things you brought up, especially with the notion about how many of her poems actually went on to be published. And many of them were kind of altered in the publications of those, at least, you know, from a punctuation standpoint, which she had major problems with. And then it does tailor to some of these notions of feminism that you're also talking about. But I love how Davies does go out of his way to make Emily Dickinson really feel like an open-minded individual, which is depicted to be a very narrow-minded world that she is living in, which helps relate to her seclusion that's actually going on as well. And I love that about it. And I think it's also reflected in Cynthia Nixon's performance, which is quite remarkable here. In fact, I would actually argue that when it comes time for the Golden Globes, I would campaign for her to be in the running for best comedic performance in a leading role, because not only is she very compelling here, and especially in the film's latter third, but she really is funny. She brings a lot of snarkiness to this film that I think goes uncompared as far as what I've seen throughout the duration of this year so far. She really is something quite unique with the sense of humor that she's able to bring.
Yeah. I also have to say, in addition to what you just mentioned there, this is a period piece, obviously, and when it comes to period pieces, a lot of people are going to be judging. Is the costumes good? Do we have really good cinematography here? You know, this film is probably does not have a high budget, but the cinematography by Florian Hofmeister is really good, and especially during those scenes where we have montage, which are, to me, the most compelling film. You know, the less, even though that there are some gems, to be honest with you, with that dialogue, when there is nothing being said, it is just as compelling, I think, as some of the dialogue that you take away with you, some of that funny dialogue, and also some of the more melancholy beats to the film as well. And the feel, it feels very authentic in terms of its time period, I will say that. So Yeah. For the sake of time, we'll get to final thoughts here. So, and also a grade. What grade would you give A Quiet Passion? And before that, I guess, give some of your final thoughts.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned how much I love Cynthia Nixon, and I want to talk about some of the other supporting characters here, one in particular. But I do want to comment on some of the aesthetics of this film that you were just talking about, because I absolutely agree with you. For a film that doesn't have such a huge budget behind it, there is a subtlety in the way that Terrence Davies chooses to depict this world. He doesn't over-dramatize the aesthetics that are going on here, which I think helps actually adds an authenticity to this world. And so when he balances that with the snarkiness and satire on the properness of these individuals, it somehow goes hand in hand for me. It doesn't create a jarring experience, but more of a seamless experience. And I have to give him a lot of credit for what he was able to achieve here. And when we talk about the film's comedic timing, I mentioned Cynthia Nixon, who is, as I said, fantastic in this film. But Keith Carradine has some of the biggest laughs in the film as well. One of them being in that moment where there is that montage of seeing these characters grow old and how that transitions into the later part of time. In that photography sequence, the photographer asks him, can you smile a bit? And he goes, I am smiling. And he's not smiling at all, as you can see. There's almost like an annoyance in his character. Yeah. And I love that about it. And there's also a few other moments, such as his reaction to when Cynthia Nixon's Emily Dickinson breaks a dirty plate for him after he asks to get it cleaned. I think that is really funny as well. So the way that it all comes together from both a character and aesthetic standpoint, I have to give it a lot of credit, and I really enjoyed watching this entire two-hour experience. As I said, I don't think it's perfect. I do think perhaps the shift from that snarkiness to the film's more somber, melancholy, and grounded final third, perhaps that's not quite as seamless as it could be. That's a very minor quibble in a film that I think actually could go down as one of my favorites of the year so far. And, you know, kind of like you were saying, Vince, I'm not the most familiar with Terrence Davies' work. I've seen Sunset Song before this one and overall really enjoyed it. But I do think A Quiet Passion is the tighter and overall more realized and seamless film in that regard. And I would probably give this an A-. I really enjoyed it and was really taken by surprise by its sense of humor that it had to offer.
Now, knowing what you have coming into it, I'm not surprised that you're coming in higher than me based on, I guess, my experience with the first third, maybe even the first half of this film. If you were to ask me at the halfway point of this film, I would probably say I was going to be negative on this movie. And I realized that it had, you know, very high marks from those critics. Obviously, you know, we talk about Rotten Tomatoes, whether that's even an accurate gauge, 92% Rotten Tomatoes, that's a... Yeah, that's pretty high. Interestingly enough, it's one of the two films that are certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes that have an actual negative reaction from the actual audience that has seen it. I think Personal Shopper, which we were all actually pretty high on, was another one of those films that didn't connect with the audience. And I feel like this one maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't connect with, I think, more general audiences for one reason or another, but I think...
I couldn't care less what they have to say. I'm here to just talk about how much I enjoyed it.
And that's perfectly understandable to do, and that's what... All we can really do is talk about our experience with films.
Yeah, and hopefully we can help them see something a bit differently if they choose to seek it out.
Absolutely. That's why we're here. That's what film critics do, at the very least.
In case you all didn't realize or didn't know that.
Try to showcase these films that a lot of people didn't have on their radar, or maybe they watched it and didn't know what to make of it, and maybe try to give you another perspective, and maybe you can come away with a different appreciation, as I often do. Oftentimes, I have a different take than what you and JD have to say, and by the end of our discussion, I say, man, maybe I should give that one another chance. This is another one of those cases of that film. It took me a while to get into that movie, into this movie, but by the end of the movie, I was actually very compelled with the story that was presented. I feel like, you know, in terms of when you and JD were talking last week about France, and you had, ultimately, your grade was very similar, even though you had very different experiences. You, I think, seem to be a little bit higher about the first half or maybe the first two-thirds of this film than I am, and maybe the last third is not as strong. I actually had the exact opposite experience, and yet... Even though I'm not going to grade it as highly as you, I still ultimately, it won me over by the end. Because of what happens in the latter half, and including the last third. So we have different experiences and different, I guess, what we look for in films. I feel like the less conversations that we have here, the more I really realize what a tremendous filmmaker that Terrence Davies can be, at least as evidenced by this film. And one, as I mentioned, I really would be intrigued to see some of his back catalog. Now I'm going to be looking at Sunset Song and some of these other films that are really highly touted, because I really did like what I saw from him as a filmmaker here in terms of his technique, in terms of drawing out really interesting notions about Emily Dickinson. You know, if you, you know, as you mentioned, if you were to talk about, hey, we're going to have a biopic about Emily Dickinson, this woman who hardly ever left her house and just wrote poems after poems and didn't really have a relationship to ever speak of or any of that, you know, big life milestones that maybe may, you know, be part and parcel of other people's biopics.
Yeah.
I would say, wow, good luck. And you're probably not going to, but Davies does find a way. And to his credit, he does find angles in this film, even though, it, you know, we talk about films that are really set in one location and how stuffy and stifling they can be. This film, I realized it was pretty much set in one location only after the fact. I didn't really, as I was watching it, I really didn't have that opinion of it because I was, you know, she has a very rich inner life and she has very rich connections with her family and with her friends in the course of this movie. I felt like I was absorbed eventually by what was going on through this film. So ultimately, I will give it, even though I'm not as high as you, I am not that far away, even though we had different reactions. I'm going to give this film a B+. I really do think that this is a film that really turned it around for me. And I think that if people are open-minded to this movie and are willing to watch this and, you know, take it for an interesting portrayal, maybe not necessarily 100% accurate portrayal of one of the great American poets that that we can talk about, but I think that it will connect the way that I think personally that Terrence Davies is able to connect with Emily Dickinson. You will also connect with both of them through the course of this movie. So I really do recommend it. Maybe not as highly, but still quite highly for my point of view. So well, we actually have some thoughts. We actually, JD posted, I think earlier today, posted a Letterboxd review. You can go check that out at letterboxd.com/insessionfilm.
Yeah, absolutely. Go check that out. And if you agree or disagree with our takes here on A Quiet Passion, you can let us know by leaving a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/InSessionFilm or tweet us at InSessionFilm. You can also leave us a comment on our Google Plus page or email us directly at InSessionFilm@gmail.com.
All right. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about quite a different kind of film, but there are some similarities, which we'll get into. It's Raw, a French film that has cannibalism as part of its theme. So we're going to get into that.
You didn't pass out during this, did you, Vince?
No, I did not, although I thought I might. So we'll be right back and we'll talk about that film in just a moment.
I'm Jason Michael.
And I'm Lee Brady, and we're the Atlantic Screen Connection Podcast. We're a podcast that looks to analyze what makes films great, with a warm atmosphere and a good laugh. New releases, retrospectives, and absolute classics all reassessed and reviewed.
You can find the Atlantic Screen Connection Podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio. And if you're looking for a more direct approach, you can find us on Twitter. Just look for Jason Michael at Atlantic SC and Lee Brady at Big Pick Reviews.
Welcome to the Atlantic Screen Connection Podcast.
Let the games begin.
Hello, cinephiles. This here is Matt Neglia, part of NextBestPicture.com, and I have one question to ask you. Do you feel like Leonardo DiCaprio really deserved it for The Revenant last year? Do you think somebody else should have won Best Actor? Well, on our podcast called the Next Best Picture Podcast, Myself, Will, Michael, and Kristen discuss that and more, as we are always looking for the best in film today and what will ultimately win the Best Picture Oscar. Join us as we review films, talk about the latest news in the awards race, as well as the film industry itself. Thank you very much for your consideration. Hey, see what I did there?
You're listening to the Incession Film Podcast Extra Film segment. Vince, what do you eat?
Cereal.
But cereal's up there.
Well, great. Now, where do you keep your raw rabbit kidneys?
T'es déjà debout?
C'est l'heure du petit-déj.
T'es parti pour nous faire un méchoui? Tu manges quoi?
Des céréales.
Sont là, les céréales.
Oui, bah ça va, je prends du lait.
All right, so Raw is written and directed by Julia DeCornau and stars Garance Marais, Ella Rumpf, Nabah Knight Ufea, as well as a few others as well. I hope I got those names right. I tried my best. If you're not familiar with Raw, it's been out for a little while and has made quite a splash in some of the circuits that it's been circulating, but it tells the story of a young vegetarian who undergoes a carnivorous hazing ritual at a vet school and eventually develops a taste for meat that begins to grow inside of her. So, Vince, I will toss it to you first. Were you able to eat on Raw?
You know, when you talk about making quite a splash, I was thinking about how supposedly, I don't know if this is a rumor, but I don't know if it's true that people were handing out, sickness bags to people before they watched this movie. So if it's making a splash.
I wasn't trying to make a pun, but apparently yeah, I did my
that's
best.
That's not the kind of splash I want to be involved with at the movie theater. Luckily, it's now on VOD, so I can watch it in the comfort, I guess, if you want to call it that, of my own home, even though yeah. I had to make sure that I watch this film without the prying eyes of my wife and five-year-old child.
Oh, man. Apparently, this was originally NC-17, so that's the last thing you want to see your family see.
You know, I will say, you know, I was not looking forward to this film because of the what people were saying about it, of being this really audacious, really, you know, about cannibalism, and there was some gross stuff in it and all this other stuff. Because when I watched it, even though there are individual scenes that are not necessarily that easy to watch from a certain perspective, I actually found it very watchable in a lot of ways. I really was compelled by what I saw. Even though some moments were not necessarily the kinds of things that I wanted to see in a film, because it was very realistically portrayed in some fashion. For the purpose of this movie, I never found it overly exploitative, and I didn't find it overly, even though there are some moments of gore, I didn't feel that it was overly gratuitous. I didn't feel like that was the main thrust of the film, was to gross people out. I do think that Julia DeCournau is trying to do some sort of body horror film here, and it reminded me actually of another movie that I saw back in, it might have come out in 2000, but I didn't see it till a few years later. It was called Ginger Snaps. It's a horror movie about girls who come of age at a certain point, and during that time, they undergo a certain metamorphosis. It's a werewolf film, basically, but and this film, while it doesn't have that kind of really big bent towards supernatural, even though some people might be able to draw some things here that are not necessarily scientific or realistic in terms of the way that things are portrayed here, there are a lot of themes that have parallels to that movie. Now, I happen to, I wanted to get some background in terms of whether Julia DeCournau had seen that film. Apparently, she has not seen that film, but she is very much intrigued to see it because some people have drawn that parallel. She does say that there is a lot of David Cronenberg in terms of her approach to body horror here. And if you've seen David Cronenberg films, and if you appreciate those, certainly this is something that's worth a look for you. Interestingly enough, her background, her mother is a gynecologist, her father is a dermatologist, I come to discover, and a lot of that comes into effect in terms of what we see on the screen here, because from a skin, you know, there's a parts where there's a skin rash that's really nasty and itchy and hard to watch. It made you want to itch yourself. And there's a scene in which
very visceral,
there's a scene in which there is a like a bikini wax scene that is not always easy to watch either,
And it climaxes in a way that is it's something else. Let's say that.
There are some climaxes in this film, one way or another. But interestingly enough, I think what DeCournau is really trying to draw forth here is that there is a correlation, I think, with someone's body and what they're feeling inside, and so this body horror is either, you know, one way to look at it is that the external is somehow evolving into what people are feeling internally. But I think that in this case, this coming of age and this feeling of isolationism and maybe even just being a fish out of water in this environment where there's hazing and all kinds of people provoking you and peer pressure and all of these other things, that it would exhibit itself internally as a lot of turmoil, and somehow externally we see the very visceral impact of that in a way that I think that a lot of people will find very much I guess people can relate to it. We relate to having rashes. We relate to the way that our bodies change as we go from youth to our puberty to beyond. You know, we have the main character here. You know, she's 16 in this film, and obviously she's not experienced a lot of things in her life, and she's being exposed to certain things that have opened her up in terms of how she views things, whether it's sexually or whether she is a lifelong vegetarian, as is her family, to the consumption of meat and what that draws out from her. You can definitely draw some metaphors to that. So Raw, despite the fact that initially I felt like this is not the kind of movie that's going to be for me, it's going to be very prurient, it's going to be very much trying to push the envelope of taste and all of these other things that a lot of movies that have very provocative premises tend to do. But I will say, I was very much into this film. I really was riveted by the story of Justine and her journey here, as well as her relation with her sister, who's a little bit more brash than she is, and her connection with others and how that manifests itself into some very dark and disturbing ways. So Raw, wow, I was really surprised by this film in a way. In a way, I'm actually glad that it was on our docket this week, because I don't know if I would have taken a chance to see it otherwise.
This
is not the kind of movie that it normally is for me, but after watching this film, it's really up there for me for this year.
Yeah, and it's finally nice to be able to catch up with it, because when it started circulating around some of the festival circuit that it had premiered in, it was getting a lot of buzz, not just for the praise that it had been getting, but for the visceral reaction that some people were having to it, as you were talking about. And when we look at writer and director here, DeCornau as well, this is apparently her first feature film, and she really delves very heavily in some of those body horror tropes that you may have seen from the likes of David Cronenberg, as you had mentioned, as well as the obvious influence, maybe not really obvious influence of Ginger Snaps, because DeCornau has mentioned that she hasn't seen that film.
Yeah.
Whether or not you believe that or not is beside the point, but there is an obvious parallel to that film. And it's in those moments of body horror, which the things that I think I was almost least looking forward to, I feel like that's where the film is at its strongest, because there's a surprising sense of satirical nature to the film as it relates to children who are overguarded by their parents and trying to make way for their own lives while they're finally on their own, especially as it relates to going to school, in this case vet school, which is, it's basically a form of college in some ways, and they go through this hazing ritual that's very much like a hazing process that they would go through like a fraternity process in some ways. There's a lot of parallels to that, and to see the experience that young Justine has to go through, not just from an edible standpoint, but from a sexual standpoint as well. And this is someone that has been heavily guarded by her parental upbringing. That's made very clear in the first maybe 5 minutes of this film. You definitely get the sense of that without the film ever having to tell you that. And I think it does it in a pretty satirical way. There's a surprising sense of, I don't want to say a sense of humor, but it is kind of snarky in the way that DeCornau chooses to emulate that. And I actually think the performance by Garance Marier here helps reflect that as well. And apparently this is also her first major feature film from an acting standpoint. And for a young age like that, she definitely has chops that I would very much look forward to seeing in other films. With that aside, though, looking at what comes in between the bones, so to speak, if I want to try to keep some of the puns going on here, I do think Raw is a very inconsistent film overall. And I think what kind of mirrors that for me comes down to some of the character relationships here, especially when we look at the relationship between Justine and her sister, Alexia, I believe her name actually is.
Yeah.
It's inconsistent to the point that it's almost on a bipolar level that I almost just couldn't quite buy into it. There are moments where it feels as though that they have a genuine loving relationship with each other, and then the next scene, it's almost as if they hate each other. And then the next scene, they love each other. Next scene, they hate each other. It constantly goes like that, and the same thing could be said about other characters here. Her relationship with her roommate, the character of Adrian, her homosexual roommate. I feel like that back and forth happens a lot. It introduces conflicts and tension between them, only in the next scene between them to act as if none of that ever happened. And the film constantly does that from a character standpoint, but for me, also from a tonal standpoint. In between those moments of body horror, I feel like DeCornau is also trying to ground this film in a way that make it feel a bit more authentic, and some of those moments felt a bit unearned for me.
Yeah.
So it basically falls into some of the traps that I think you tend to see a lot in a first-time writer and director. I think it's a very fascinating experience, and some of those moments of body horror are incredibly visceral, sometimes frightening, sometimes disgusting, and it's a very ugly movie, and I mean that as a compliment. I like the ugliness of some of these moments. But with all of that said, I think what comes in between does create for a pretty inconsistent experience for me overall.
Yeah, it sounds like we're having kind of the opposite reaction between A Quiet Passion, where some of the things that I had as far as the interactions, some of the problems I had didn't bother you at all, maybe even considered to be some of the strengths. I actually feel a lot of the things that you're bringing up didn't bother me at all. Maybe I even consider them some of the strengths for me as well, because I feel I feel like a lot of this has to do with the confusion of being a teenager and being in this environment and not knowing exactly what you want, and this struggle that, at least in terms of the Justine character, in her case, she's trying to, you know, she's struggling between, is she human, is she animal, I guess, in terms of, you know, what's going on internally and externally to her body and her desires and all of these other things. Her sister, who seems to be a little bit, you know, she's more mature, she's more resolved as to whether she's going to be more animal or whether she's going to be more human, is also trying to deal with the fact that she has this sister who she obviously has feelings for, but she also has her own desires and her the things that drive her that I guess she's not as conflicted by. So therefore, she's willing to indulge more in that and then still try to relate to his sister on another level that they had already established growing up. Roommate as well, yes, you know, I think that's another case of sexual confusion, and that's all part of, you know, being a teenager, in this case, whether 16, 17, 18, and not knowing exactly what you want. Obviously, you know, people experiment with different things, and, you know, it doesn't always stay consistent, but I feel like if I'm being more generous, I guess, to Julie DeCornau as far as what she's trying to bring here, I might say, for me, it didn't bother me as much because I feel like that's just a part of being a teenager, not knowing exactly what you want. Maybe your relationships with your siblings, maybe your relationships with your roommates are, you know, they're kind of frenemies to a certain extent. You know, sometimes they're on your side, sometimes you just want to bite them, right? So... So, you know, I think it captures some of that. I really like the use of music here, montage. I like symbolism in this film. This really does touch all the buttons that I enjoy when it comes to, you know, I don't know if I would be comfortable saying strictly that this is a horror film. I think that there are horrific elements to it. I certainly think that if people are going to put this into a genre, maybe they would put it into a horror film, but I don't know.
Visually, I think it's most comparable to that, but I honestly, if you wanted to argue that this was a drama, I think you could. If you wanted to argue that this was a comedy, I think you could. As a horror film, I think you could also do that too.
A coming of age drama or comedy, sure, you can do that. Yeah. All of those elements are in there. It really is a hodgepodge of a lot of different styles, and some of which you've seen before and some of which you've never seen really in this combination. At least I haven't. Maybe I've just steered away from these kinds of movies generally. I like certain moments in this film that really stick with me. The music montages, some of the choices there, the way that DeCornau slows down or really captures kind of the vibe, the internal vibe by what we see outside, to be able to capture mood, I think is really good, even from a first-time filmmaker. You know, some of the symbolisms, the horse being sedated, it really stays with me. You know, how it kind of it reminded me of how that horse, which is this magnificent beast, is also at the mercy of his body, or her body, and once that body is, you know, made, put, you know, to collapse, sedated, basically, how the body really does affect how you can govern it. You have no control over it. And I feel like that is really what's embodied in that scene. There's a like kind of
probably
of a
the most frightening scene for me personally. If I have to,
that's
be
a hard, the hardest scene for me happened to be with somebody scooping something out of a cow. I had a hard time watching that one. Of
I actually
the
found that really
movie.
Funny. I actually think that went pretty well in the film sense of satire.
That was the only time when I actually had to look away. I was just like, oh yikes. but anyway, there's a scene where there's this stuffed doll being hung at this party at the end of this really long a scene, like almost like an unbroken take, where we see a stuffed sheep that is being hung, and it reminded me of not only the hazing, but this feeling of conformity that they're trying to force upon these new students that are in this veterinary school of being, you know, following them, follow the peers like this sheep, and also what that implies if you do follow that, it's going to lead to the murder of self. And at least that's how I read that into this film, because she obviously has her own path. Some of the other symbolism, Marquis de Sade did a book, one of his early books, called Justine or the Misfortune of Virtue. I have a feeling that the name Justine, being this is a French movie. Yeah,
that's a parallel.
Yeah, this definitely has some parallels. The sexual awakening in that, and I feel like that for a first-time filmmaker, there are many allusions, and it is kind of a film literate kind of movie. Maybe some people will recognize a lot of other movies, but I think that it works in its favor here. I really feel that in the end, Julia Ducournau is actually making something that is a Julia Ducournau film.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think some of the symbolism there, one thing I really respect, and this is one of my favorite things about the film, is when it does touch on some of those notions of sexual awakening, there's a beautiful scene, not really beautiful, but a beautifully shot scene, at least, that involves a party with a bunch of paint, where people are covered in paint and then forced to put two people together. And they, Justine is covered in blue paint, I believe. Yeah. The male is covered in yellow paint. They say, don't come out until you're green. And obviously everyone knows that, you know, blue and yellow make green together. Yeah. So that's so take that for what you will.
I was wondering when red was going to be put into that, what color they would be when they come out of that one,
oh,
too.
Oh, my gosh. Don't even get me started on that. but there are a few other notions, too, you know. And one of my favorite, even though I criticize the relationship between Justine and her roommate Adrian, maybe some of the bipolarity of it, and maybe somehow it leads to moments that are a bit forced and unearned for me personally. One of the more fascinating elements is how she develops kind of an attraction to him, even though he is explicitly stating that he is homosexual. There is a bit of jealousy that kind of forms between Justine and her own sister as it relates to Adrian. Some of those elements I found pretty fascinating too.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there is no, even though, you know, this is a film directed by a woman, written by a woman, starring primarily women, there are things in this film that are not, you know, this is not necessarily trying to say these are women and this is what women have to do necessarily, even though some people may read into it. They're shown as playing video games and doing other things that, you know, bros do, you know, typically in these kinds of movies. So I think that it's really trying to upend a lot of our expectations in a lot of ways and unsettle us from what we're, I guess, accustomed to in seeing films like this. And one of the things that I really draw upon this in terms of the way that this film goes, in terms of this kind of metamorphosis from this innocent being, this vegetarian and virgin to some extent, I guess, or maybe quite literally here, is this understanding of what it is to be human. And you can only really understand what it is to be human by also knowing the costs involved with becoming the monster. And that internal strife that I think that most people, I think, undergo when it comes to their baser impulses makes them uniquely human, because I think animals, when we talk about animals, just go by their impulses generally. They don't moralize.
They have an instinct,
They just do. They eat what they think, what they're hungry for. They copulate with whatever that, you know, those indulgences are there, and they have no shame and they have no thinking about it. What makes us human is this, you know, this feeling of, well, we have these impulses, and certainly, you know, Justine and has those here, but her struggle is, will I lose my humanity by actually going with what my impulses say. And I think that ultimately, I think that's something that we all struggle with, especially during our teenage years. We have all these new feelings, all of these new desires and anxieties, and they all manifest themselves internally. Here we see them externally, and I think that we can readily identify with Justine. And like you mentioned, that humor that's in here, that comic relief, which works, and this is one of the actually parallels that I have with Quiet Passion, is that we relate to Emily Dickinson because we can laugh at what's going on in her life, not laugh at them, but laugh with her and her family because they're very funny. I think that that same levity, that sense of humor works really well with helping us relate to Justine and her foibles and what these students are going through in this film as well.
Yeah, and I think that's where it is at its strongest overall, and especially in that sense of humor. I think that's where it is the most balanced. It does become a double-edged sword for me because I still find some of the tonal imbalances here pretty strong, which I think is what actually is the reason why it kind of suffocates some of those notions of coming of age that you were talking about, which I do think the film is ultimately going for, but I do think it does stifle some of those notions as well as some of the character dichotomies that I think the film was also going for. It does become a little lost in it in the long run for me because of some of those inconsistencies, and that's what kind of, I wouldn't say it breaks the film, but it makes me a lot less in the film than you are overall. For the sake of time, let's get to final thoughts and grades, though. So Vince, any final thoughts, and what grade would you give Raw?
Yeah, a lot of this will come down to probably maybe what we expect going in and the level at which we are accustomed to seeing films like this. Now, I steer clear away from a lot of body horror, to be honest with you. So I don't see a lot of these kinds of movies. So I don't know how it relates for some people who are really into it, whether this is a really great example or if this is actually cribbing from a lot of other things that they may have seen. But for me, it took me more by surprise because of that. And I actually was into it. I would have no problems watching it again. I would probably wouldn't even flinch at that cow scene now that I know what's going on in that scene.
You know it's coming now, yeah.
I'm sure I will watch this again sometime soon. Not necessarily something I would... obviously, this is not the kind of movie that I would recommend to, you know, just anybody, as we say.
Don't show your kid this.
Don't show your kids this. Your coworkers may not speak to you again, depending on... But maybe they will, depending on whether they like this kind of thing. This definitely is one of those... it's a matter of taste, I guess. Now, I don't necessarily have a penchant for this kind of movie, but I still was very entertained and very absorbed by what's going on in this film, enough to give it a pretty high grade here. So I really like what it says about humanity, and also this feeling, this coming of age, and this feeling of desires and this awakening, and how that for the same reason I actually enjoyed back in the day Ginger Snaps as well. I even like this movie more than Ginger Snaps, even though it does have a lot of parallels to a movie that came out almost 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So for this, I really did was taken by surprise by this film enough to give it an A-. I think that this is a pretty strong film from Julia Ducournau. I would be very interested in what she comes out with next. And Garance Marié, as you mentioned, great performance here. I felt very in the moment with this film, not only because it's a visceral film, but it does have that kind of subtext, that symbolism, that deeper, I guess, understanding that I actually do thrive on as somebody who really studies and analyzes film as well. So A- is, you know, that's a strong recommendation for me.
Very much so. And I would actually be very much intrigued to see what else that Ducournau is able to churn up as a director, because if I can find another film of hers in the future that is a bit more consistent for me personally, I will probably be very strong on it in the same way that you are with this film. But some of those tonal inconsistencies and how that translates to character inconsistencies for me, I think drowns out some of the coming of age elements that I think would have helped mitigate some of those character inconsistencies for me. But as far as final thoughts for me, I want to talk about another notion to this film thematically that I was able to take away from it. And I mentioned this briefly in my opening thoughts, but it has to do with the notion of parenting. And one of the strongest things that Ducournau really tries to emulate is the idea of being over-sheltered by your parents at a young age, with Justine being a vegetarian and kind of forced into it. And now that she's finally on her own, kind of being influenced by others her own age, and how that forces her to kind of awaken who she truly is. That's something a lot of us can relate to the first time we ever go to college, for example. It's very much a parallel to that in some ways. And I found those notions itself pretty strong. And I don't want to get into spoilers, but there's a final revelation in this film that's I will say at first I thought, okay, that's pretty interesting. And then I started to think about it a little bit more only a couple seconds later, and I thought, no, that doesn't work at all. And then I started to think about it a little bit more. I was like, you know what? No, that actually makes a lot of sense, because it actually helps justify the reasons why parents might choose to overshelter their children, because there are a lot of times that children are known to grow up and end up just like their parents. Maybe sometimes those respective parents don't want their children to end up like themselves. And I think that this film is, in some ways, the argument on that notion. And I think that helps kind of justify some of the sheltering that these parents were providing for their two children here in some ways. That's some of the most fascinating elements of this film. And I think that actually is nicely parallel to some of the body horror elements in relation to that. And as I said, I think it's in those elements where the film is at its strongest and most well-balanced. It's just in between the ribs, you know, the meat between the ribs sometimes does become a bit inconsistent for me, as I said. And some of those inconsistencies are the reasons why I would probably give this film, from a grade standpoint, I'm kind of toying between a B minus to a B. I would still recommend it in the long run because it has a lot of great elements to it, and I want to see what else DeCornau has up her sleeve from as a writer and director. You know, I think on Letterboxd, I would probably give this 3 out of 5 stars. So take that for what you will. It's somewhere. I would give it a B minus. I think that's probably the best I can say, because if it wasn't for those inconsistencies, I would be so much higher on it. And because I was looking forward to this film, it did make it slightly disappointing that it wasn't as consistent for me personally. So that's where I sit on the film Raw. But if you want to hear some more of our thoughts, be sure to look out on our Letterboxd page at letterboxd.com/incessionfilm, where we should hopefully get some more thoughts on Raw there as well.
And if you agree or disagree with our takes, please let us know. Leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/incessionfilm. You can also tweet us at incessionfilm. You can also leave us a comment on our Google Plus page or email us at incessionfilm@gmail.com.
All right, well, that'll do it for this week's show. Again, just a friendly reminder, if you want to follow us on social media, you can just search for In Session Film, and you'll find us on all of those various networks. We also respond to every piece of email that we get, so you can email us directly at InSessionFilm@gmail.com. We will get back to you as soon as we can.
And also be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, any place where you download your podcast. Click that subscribe button. Also, if you happen to be on iTunes, please leave us a review. We greatly appreciate all of the feedback we get there. Our podcasts are also syndicated every week at geekcastradio.com and the LAMB Podcast Network. And also, please be sure to check out our Listen Now page on our website at insessionfilm.com/listen-now.
And the In Session Film Podcast is supported by our awesome listeners like you. If you want to help us, just go to our website at InSessionFilm.com. Click on our bonus content tab on our main menu to hear all of our bonus content for just a small donation of 99 cents. You can also go to the In Session Film store, or just go to InSessionFilm.com/donate to see all of our information there and how you can help us. One thing I would highly recommend, though, is to check out our mobile app. For just a one-time fee of $1.99, you can see everything we do under one roof right there. You can find that app on the Amazon market for Android devices, the Windows 10 phone store for Windows devices, and the podcast source app for iOS devices. All those details are on our site at InSessionFilm.com/apps. As for the main show this weekend, myself and JD will be talking about the latest installment in the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. God help us all. So, but to alleviate some of that potential pain that we might have to endure. Hopefully not. Hopefully we have some fun with it. But we'll also be talking about a recap on the Cannes Film Festival, and also talking about our overall favorite films to ever win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival since back in the 1920s, back when it was still the Grand Prize Award as far as what it was named. So it kind of went through a few different names there. But we'll talk about some of our favorite films to ever win that coveted award. Before we get out of here, though, Vince, do you have any final thoughts on anything before we leave today?
You know, just speaking of the fifth film in the Pirates of the Caribbean series, I am actually glad that we reviewed A Quiet Passion and Raw for this week and not this retrospective on the first four films in the series, because I would have found that so hard to endure. Those are long films, and I've seen all four of them, and I really don't want to revisit any of them again. Mm-hmm. Even the first one that a lot of people are high on, I was not. So thank goodness we have some really notable films to talk about here.
Yeah, we did that just for you, Vince.
Really. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I kind of share some of those sentiments on the Pirates franchise. I kind of like the second one the best, believe it or not, but I can't say I love any of them. I think there are some enjoyable moments, but I find them like you said, kind of overlong, kind of, and at least some of them kind of forgettable in some ways, and they bleed together in so many ways too. So maybe Dead Men Tell No Tales will hopefully be the outlier, or it'll prove that these men are dead and should no longer tell any tales. We shall see. But as far as final thoughts for me, I do want to briefly mention that as much as we wanted to pay some of our thoughts and prayers to Zack Snyder and his family, as well as to Roger Moore and to his friends and family, I do also want to share that our thoughts and prayers go out to all those that may have been affected by the bombing in Manchester not terribly long ago, right after the Ariana Grande concert. And I also want to give a lot of praise and kind words to those that opened up their doors to help the potential victims after that bombing in Manchester. You know, there was a lot of social media tweeting going around offering room and food and shelter for those individuals. And it just goes to show the power and good fortune and positive vibes that a lot of people have these days, especially in times of terror like that. And as unfortunate as these times could be, there are a lot of good people out there willing to help. And I think that there's some great light at the end of the tunnel. So I just wanted to make note of that as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you guys next time on the In Session Film Podcast.
Because I was going to go with, you go with this to church, Mr. Cassidy? Of course not. Going to church is like going to a Transformers film. You only enjoy it after you've gotten home.
That one's also pretty good.